It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Replacing Jeff Jarvis this week, we've got Mike Elgin off his visit to Cuba. He's got some interesting news from Cuba, a little kind of inside look at what's going on in that island nation. Danny Sullivan from Search Engine Land is also here. We'll talk about the latest from Facebook bots to Google's EU problem. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 349, recorded Wednesday, April 20th, 2016. The Weekly Packet. This Week in Google is brought to you by Headspace. Train your mind for a healthier, less stressed life. Download the free Headspace app and begin their Take 10 program for 10 days of guided meditation at headspace.com/twig. And by Automattic, the connected car company that improves your driving and integrates your car into your digital life. For more information, visit automattic.com/twit and enter the code TWIT to get 20% off your purchase. And by Harry's, for guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. For a limited time, new customers can get a free trial and pay just $3 for shipping by going to harrys.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we get together and talk about whatever the hell we damn well want to. Mostly because there's so much good stuff to talk about that this is the last show I do of the week, and I realized this morning, oh, I get it. All the news stories that I couldn't do on Mac Break Weekly or Windows Weekly, we slide them down to This Week in Google. So it's Facebook, the cloud, European Commission, whatever we can't fit in anywhere else. But this makes it fun. And, of course, Jeff Jarvis is the leader of the pack. He is joining us today from Germany. So no video from Jeff. We think the audio will be okay.
And leader of the pack.
It is late at night there.
Yeah.
And I think the latency is about 20 seconds. So I'm a little worried. But we'll do our best.
Oh, Jesus.
Jeff, by the way, is a new Dvorak. The first about 3 years of Twit, Dvorak was always the one coming in on some sort of bad line. There was one entire Twit where we couldn't hear him, so he would type into Messenger. You could try this, Jeff, and then I would read his responses on Google Messenger. Also with us from SearchEngineLand.com, Danny Sullivan, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us from the Balboa Peninsula, which sounds exotic.
Indeed. But it's not.
It's San Diego, basically.
Yeah. Well, no, Orange County.
All right.
Okay. Right between San Diego and Los Angeles, the forgotten city.
Midway.
Area, yeah.
And yes, ladies and gentlemen, Mike Elgin is on the road, but I'm so pleased to welcome him back to our microphones, as they used to say in the radio days. Where are you these days?
The Yucatan Peninsula. We're all on a peninsula today. You're in the Petaluma Peninsula.
I'm in the valley, the Petaluma Valley, but hey, the Yucatan.
Yeah, I'm in Cancun, Mexico.
So you're on the east coast of Mexico.
That's right.
After a jaunt through Cuba.
Spent a month in Cuba.
So jealous.
And that was really something, I tell
you. You no stranger to Cuba. You'd stayed there before and had wonderful stories to tell. First of all, had it changed much?
It's changed massively, actually. The internet is a major factor that is completely changing in Cuba now. Even though only a minority of people can get on it, there are these public Wi-Fi hotspots. You know, Communist Party supplied Wi-Fi hotspots have existed for a year now. When I went in 2008, there were probably three or four Wi-Fi hotspots in the entire country, and they were all tourist hotels in Havana. And that's what I used back then to get online and do my work and so on. Nowadays, there's something like 60 Wi-Fi hotspots in the country. They're slow, super expensive, and sometimes hard to find. In some of the other cities around the country, there's literally one Wi-Fi hotspot in the entire city. So
that's hard to imagine a modern country without, ubiquitous internet.
They use it as a means of control for now. The government is really concerned about rapid reorientation of the country to the global stage. So they've slowly liberalized. They've let people travel abroad. But this whole internet thing is something that's very scary. Now, the way that they do it now, part of it is a source of revenue for the government. It costs about $2.19 per hour to use the Wi-Fi. We spent about $300 on Wi-Fi in the month that we were there. But more importantly to the government, when you buy these Wi-Fi cards that give you either 1 or 5 hours online, you have to show your ID. They log exactly who you are associated with exactly what card. So when you use this Wi-Fi, everything that I do, they know that it's Mike Elgin this connection. So it's a source of intimidation and control that they don't want to give up. So they don't let restaurants, they don't let nightclubs or coffee shops or private homes have internet connectivity for the most part. Some high-level government people can have dial-up broadband. But other than that, they want to know that every single person exactly what they're doing online.
That's, it's almost hard to believe that it's still, that's worse than China.
It's far worse than China. And of course, it is censored internet. People think, Cuba has always been a tourist destination. It's a beautiful island with amazing beaches and beautiful people, amazing music. It's a wonderful place to visit on vacation. And this gives Cuba a kind of halo effect that makes people not realize what a totalitarian communist dictatorship it is. In fact, we tried to stay outside of the tourist bubble. We lived in regular apartments. We shopped in regular stores. And it's a brutal place to live for Cubans. This is why so many of them are still trying to leave, even with the liberalization. It's a very, very tough place. Nothing works. The infrastructure's crumbling. We talked to some Canadian friends there who did an all-inclusive resort package in one of these high-end resorts in Veradero. They charge exactly as much as you'd charge at any other country, and yet they didn't have water for 4 days.
Ugh.
They didn't. We were in an apartment where the water went out of the apartment, and the only way we restored water is the Airbnb host that was renting to us paid somebody to bring a truck and fill the cisterns for the whole building, and that was the only way he could get us water. Wow. The rest of the people in the building were very grateful for that. But Cuba is a mess because of the restrictive government. They have two currencies. People are incredibly poor, and they have food rationing and so on. It's a very, very, very tough place to live, and they definitely need Google. They need the internet. And I'm afraid that it may be a while before they really actually get online in any sort of meaningful way.
It's such an eye opener. We people say first world problems and stuff, but you really don't really appreciate what that means until you hear stories like this. When we're all worried about, Google's watching what I do on the internet, and that's nothing compared to what people in Cuba are putting up with. How much of their poverty and suffering, though, is because of sanctions from the U.S.?
Well, it's difficult to say. I've talked to a lot of well-educated Cubans while I was there because I never quite understood it. I mean, Cuba trades with China. They trade with Italy. They trade with most U.S. allies, really. They trade with most of the world freely, theoretically. Most of their problems are about the U.S. control of the international banking system. And so they can't raise money very easily. Yeah. But my sense is that the vast majority of their economic problems are the result of the fact that most businesses are owned by the government. There's no choice. There's no competition. Government bureaucracies are notoriously inefficient. You go to the store, and it's not like, should I buy this kind of cooking oil, or should I buy Wesson oil, or should I buy Crisco, or should I buy this, that, and the other thing? No. You go there, and this is the one brand that you have, and it's a brand that's owned by the government. Almost everything is owned by the government. Mm. And so any country that has tried to run the entire economy has ended up being extremely poor. Now, Cuba is very lucky in two ways in terms of their economic situation. They have 3.5 million tourists now coming to the island, dropping, like we spent $4,000 in 4 weeks.
Which is a good deal. But for Cuba, that must be a ton of money, right?
It's a ton of money. I mean, And they also, Cuba also essentially takes money that is earned by the public. For example, we know one person who worked for another government. I won't specify the government because I don't want to get anywhere near identifying who this person was, but he worked for a Western government in an office inside Havana. And he was paid, you know, I don't know, some regular salary, probably $2,500 a month. The Cuban government takes all of that and then pays him $30 a month.
What?
That's how it works.
Holy cow.
They just take money for everything.
Wow.
The Cuban government nickels and dimes every single thing they can get. For example, if you take a bus across the country in Cuba, as all the tourists do, it's one of the best ways to get around. They have bathrooms in the bus. They're Korean buses. And they lock the buses, and then they stop at these rest stops, and they charge you up to a dollar something to use the bathroom. Little things like that, they're always, and that's, you know, of course, that's going directly to the Castro administration.
Is Castro and his family getting rich? What happens to all this money?
Well, it's sort of backwards from the way things normally work. I don't think the Castro's claim that they live like ordinary Cubans, I think for the most part, that's mostly true. They're not living in Saddam Hussein style palaces for sure. They don't seem to be living high on the hog. But the way things normally work is people have private businesses, they make lots of money, and then they're taxed. And governments get their money through taxation primarily. In Cuba, there's no real taxation. They basically just take the money directly. And so in order to fund the whole government on a very small GDP, I mean, they don't produce much except sugar and rum and a few other things. And they have tourism, and they have a lot of remittances from Cubans in the U.S., just sending money to relatives. That's another source, a multi-billion dollar source of revenue for the country. They just have to take money wherever they can get it. It's a terrible system. It doesn't work. They're unable to keep up with the crumbling infrastructure. They can barely keep people fed. People are always on the brink of, like, you know, hunger. Almost everybody. It's a fairly equitable system, especially compared to the
In the sense that everybody's suffering equally.
Everybody's suffering. I mean, you know, people are not actually starving, but you go to the store and, you know, there'll be big shortages and outages of things here, there, and the other thing. And it's kind of like the old Soviet Union. If there's a line forming, you get in it and you find out what they're selling when
later.
You get there, because if there's a line, it must be good. You must need it. You had this big surge in tourism. Was really interesting to see. With Obama there, and lots of people from all over the world, including the U.S., but also Europe and Canada, all the usual suspects, came rushing into Cuba, and they just don't have the market mechanisms to respond to demand. So there are all these stories about how Cuba was running out of beer, and they were running out of water, and they're running out of these simple things purely through distribution and manufacturing, which in a capitalist economy, there are all kinds of mechanisms to satisfy that demand. I mean, you know, Walmart has a supercomputer to predict when there will be rushes on water, and they make sure they stock it early and all this stuff. None of that stuff exists. They just run out of stuff. And so they even ran out of Wi-Fi cards. There was a couple of days right after Obama's visit where you couldn't use the internet because you couldn't buy the cards. It's not because they had a lack of capacity with the Wi-Fi. They physically didn't get the cards to the places that sold the cards.
Wow.
Weird stuff like that you just would never think of.
That is, it's kind of shocking, and it just shows you even in a small island, relatively small island, a centralized planned economy doesn't work. It's fascinating. Do you think the removal of trade barriers is going to change things? It sounds like there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think people quite understand the how far behind Cuba really is. I mean, one of the things that Cuba is really excited about the removal of trade barriers, is it's a very agriculture-based economy. And they're still using tractors from the 40s and the 30s.
I saw the pictures that you posted of Cuban transportation, a continuing series.
Yeah,
amazing.
So one of the first things that was sort of liberalized was there is a company in the United States that can actually provide parts for these ancient tractors. And the Cubans are super excited about that. They're not they can't even think about modern tractors. And if you think about tractors are amazingly high tech now. They're almost self-driving. They're incredibly computerized.
They just want to fix the ones they've got.
They just want to fix the one from 1935
wow.
because it's broken and they need, you know. So it's they've got a long, long way to go. And this is one of the barriers in which the Cuban government's well aware of is they have two currencies. There's a currency for locals and then there's a currency for tourists.
I did not know that.
Yeah. My wife calls the one for locals the people's peso. It's not what it's called, but it's fun to call them peepees. And sometimes we had those, and we use those to buy things. And then if you're a tourist, you use CUCs, C-U-Cs, and those are tied to the dollar and so on. But the average Cuban wage is between $15 and $30 a month. A month, Leo. The economic disparity with the rest of the world is so out of whack that.
Well, and that puts a $2 Wi-Fi card into perspective. I mean, you're not going to buy that.
Yep. And so there's a dual economy now of people who have friends and relatives in the U.S. who can send them iPhones. And then there's people who couldn't imagine ever having an iPhone.
Yeah.
And so it's got a long way to go. The government is aware that it's an unworkable problem. And they're also aware that. Sort of they're kept in power by this cult of personality around the Castros. Raul Castro is in his 80s. Fidel Castro is in his 90s. That's not going to last too long. So they're struggling for solutions. They don't want to give up power. Who does? Meanwhile, the Cuban people are champing at the bit to move forward and join the world as a liberalized economy. And I think that theoretically, you know, two of the achievements they talk about with the revolution are the education system and the healthcare system. I can't speak directly about whether or not they have successfully done those things, but they seem to have they have high literacy. They have 99% literacy, which is really great.
That's amazing.
They have a lot of people who speak English, so they have lots of engineers. So theoretically, you know, in a capitalist world, the sort of the jobs rush to the low end of the market where you have high education and low wages. So Cuba could become like this. New Singapore or what China was a few years ago or something, potentially, if the government would just allow it.
When you hear about this poverty and this desperate circumstances, and then you read stories about the lung cancer vaccine, for instance, that Cuba's had for years, you wonder how such a thing could happen. And you really feel for the people. And I do hope that something can happen for them to make their lives better. What a tragedy.
Yeah. And I do recommend that everybody visit Cuba if you can.
It's going to change, but maybe not
change.
As fast as
it's
we thought.
Like it is now.
Yeah.
But it's an interest. It was a really fascinating place to go because, again, we really tried to live like Cubans. We lived in regular apartments. We shopped in regular stores. We made a lot of friends. We had a lot of candid conversations. One thing that's very different now. When we were in 2008, everybody's scared to death to say anything to us. And now people are just openly criticizing
the government. Oh, interesting.
Out loud. And so there's a lot of boldness. There's a sense that things are changing.
Good.
And I think they really are.
Good. Yeah, and I don't know if they were much better under Batista. I mean, he was pretty corrupt himself.
Yeah.
And
And there were multiple revolutions in the 20th century. And the U.S. invaded several times. It was not a great... situation. There's just got to be a way for Cuba to have its independence, to have a certain amount of equality, but also, I mean, one of the shocking things I mentioned before the show that I went to the Rolling Stones. The Rolling Stones came to Havana for the first time, and I didn't realize this aspect of it, but everybody was talking about this because only a few years ago it was illegal to even listen to the Rolling Stones. You know, popular music was literally illegal. You could literally go to jail for having an album or a CD with music on it. And that's a degree of repression that is just pretty outrageous. So this whole Rolling Stones event was just like, wow, it's a new world. You know, there were actual Cubans saying from now on, we'll measure everything as being before or after the Rolling Stones.
Isn't that interesting? Wow. Mike Elgin, who's just off a month in Cuba, he's now in Mexico and Cancun. If you want to follow Mike's travels, he's back to the peripatetic Mike Elgin we know and love. If you want to follow his travels, of course, on Google Plus, he's still posting there, and I noticed a lot of them. Is everything making it to Facebook as well?
Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, and you have a blog now.
And I have a blog called becomingnomad.com. It's sort of a site about the digital nomad lifestyle. And it's a combination of observations, tips, things I've learned, things I've gone through. So it's more of a specific, narrow focus on the digital, you know, living abroad as a digital nomad.
Yeah.
For anybody who's interested in that sort of thing.
Must read and continue to follow, Mike. And I'm hoping that you will continue to be places with some internet so we can get you on our shows. We missed having you. Although I
hope so too.
There's hot dogs. A staple, apparently, in Cuba.
In our first Airbnb, that came with breakfast, and they were feeding us hot dogs every morning for breakfast. And it was kind of like, why are we having hot dogs every day? It's considered a legitimate meat or meat byproduct.
It's a gourmet treat. Are you kidding?
You can put anything in it.
Look at the cars, though. And, of course, while we think, oh, this is wonderful, they're keeping these beautiful cars, these vintage cars alive, this is what they have. This is it.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. Danny, thank you for being patient while we caught up with Mike's travels around the world.
No worries at all.
Isn't it fascinating, though? It's just, I'd like
to go there. It's always weird for me because, you know, my wife's British and we lived in Britain for 12 years, and you would walk down the streets, and especially in Britain, going on holiday or vacation, such a big industry that, like, on the main street, there's always these tourism shops and there's all these places you could go, and there'd always be things like trips to Cuba, and I'd always be like, what? I mean, you know, because you couldn't go there if you're in the U.S. and you would realize, wow, everybody else is going over there. It's weird that we couldn't go to this island that was like, you know, 90 miles next to us. So, yeah, well, it's very exciting to see all the stuff that's happening.
I really didn't realize the depth of poverty and repression that was going on there. I mean, it sounds almost as bad as North Korea. It sounds really horrific. And so I appreciate the update, Mike. And we will get back to matters of the internet. It feels so shallow to talk about the kinds of things we normally talk about. You know, whining about various minor inconveniences on the internet. When you hear about
and
stories
yet
like that,
my Wi-Fi didn't work yesterday.
Yeah, gosh darn it! Cannot get a good Wi-Fi signal in the gym.
Could
the jacuzzi,
not treat Mr. Robot. What was I supposed to do?
You know what it always impresses me is the spirit of humanity to even through such a horrible, I mean, 50, 60 years, the human spirit survives and a beautiful people who have managed to survive in, just very challenging circumstances. It kind of is encouraging.
And one last thing, Leo, on Cuba, if I may, along those lines, the desire to have the internet is so strong in Cuba that one of the ways they get it is on a thumb drive. There's this type of business called the weekly packet. You subscribe to it. It costs a couple of bucks a week. And every week you get a new thumb drive. You give them the old thumb drive, they give you the new one. And on that thumb drive are Netflix movies, YouTube videos.
Wow.
There's a kind of Cuban Craigslist with listings on it. There's just a mishmash of the kinds of things people would get on the internet. It's like a slow offline internet. And it's very, very popular. It's the main way that people get internet content, even if they don't have the internet.
Isn't that fascinating? A sneaker net.
Yeah.
People want the internet. And I don't blame them. I don't blame them. Yeah.
House of Cards is very popular in Cuba.
You're kidding.
No. You get it on the little thumb drive. Every week there's a new episode.
Wow. What is it? The weekly packet?
The weekly packet.
Yeah, but who can afford it if it's that much?
People are willing to pay it.
I mean,
it's a valuable link to the outside world.
$8 a month is like a third of your income. It's like, it's incredible.
It's a lot.
Our show is brought to you today by Headspace. Love Headspace. And I use it daily. It's on my phone. You can get it on an iPhone or an Android phone. Your mind, you know, sometimes where the enemy is within, comes from within, is fear and anger and stress and anxiety and waking up in the middle of the night. And it's hard to get through a night's sleep or a day, a busy day, but you don't have to live this way. And it all starts with 10 minutes of guided meditation every day. And this comes from the amazing Andy Puddicombe. If you've not seen his TED Talk, you've got to watch it. He leads all the meditations. And I hear Andy in my head now. And it just, you know, if I get a little stressed Andy just says something and it just calms me down in my head. Headspace is meditation made simple. There are also thousands of scientific studies that show the positive effects, like improving focus, relationship harmony, literally decreasing anxiety and stress. I started doing it. My physician said, you have to manage the stress in your life. That's going to kill you. And this is a great solution. We can get you started with a 100% free Take 10 program, 10 meditation sessions. That's all it takes. 10 days of doing this, and I think you'll immediately see benefits and understand why now 5 million people, this is an amazing number, use Headspace on their computer, on their device, their tablet, their phone. I pump it through my Amazon Dot into my speakers and listen in the house. It's just great. Download the free Headspace app and take 10 days of guided meditation at headspace.com/twig. Train your mind for a healthier, less stressed life. Start your free trial today. headspace.com/twig. Andy Puddicombe is a nice voice to have in your head. We should call the show the Weekly Packet, says W.D. Mark P.C. He says, you guys talk about so much. This I like that. Maybe we should rename it. Instead of This Week in Google, the Weekly Packet. There is a lot of Google news, particularly this morning, the news that the EU has finally ended their year-long investigation, their antitrust investigation, and charged, I don't know what this means exactly, if they've charged them or whatever, but Google has 12 weeks to respond to the statement of objections. The commission says that with 90% market share, by the way, that's significantly more than here in the States, right, Danny, it's what is it in the States, 60, 70%?
For search
Google,
market share?
Google search market share, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's estimated to be around 60 to 70%.
Why is it 90% in Europe?
Because Microsoft's not even trying.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they're literally not even trying. If you go over there and you try to use a version of Bing, they usually don't have the latest features that have been added to it, or the country-specific stuff is not even there. And, you know, the French search engines that were supposed to get funding and challenge Google didn't. And so, you know, it's just become de facto because there's just no one really doing that, with the exception of Russia, which is in the EU, of course. But, you know, that's really been it. They just wiped out the competition, and it was much harder for anybody to challenge. Yahoo, you know, which in the U.S. was a counter to Google for a very long period of time, had been weaker in Europe as well. You know, and each individual market's smaller too, right? You know, so it's like, you know, you're going to fight it out in France or Germany or the U.K. and so on, so...
But this is how Microsoft is fighting it. This whole
it's kind of because of Microsoft's prompting, right?
Fair Search,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Fair Search is the complainer in this case, and Fair Search is a Microsoft lobbying organization that exists to take down Google in every way it possibly can. Oracle's involved and others.
Well, it was backed by Microsoft. It was never entirely Microsoft, and actually, Microsoft has pulled out of Fair Search now.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. They're not – they apparently are not – and I think
well, their job is done.
Exactly. I mean, there's no doubt that Microsoft helped make this happen. And in some ways, it's sort of like turnabout is fair play, because in 2009, Google was really hammering away, and before that, about Microsoft and Internet Explorer, and you're so dominant on the mobile you're so dominant on the desktop that you shouldn't be able to let people choose what their browser is or their search, you know, and that's the reason why. And I think it still runs to this day that in the EU, you know, a Windows computer will ask you to pick your search provider when you turn it on and it starts up. And so
not only your search provider, your browser, because that was
your browser.
Yeah, there's the browse, we call it the browser ballot, where they say which browser would you like to be your default, and that's over now, that just ended.
But Google really pushed for that. You know, Google was like, yeah, we need to have this because they're just too dominant. And so now Google is going to be taken up in part by the same kind of actions it took against Microsoft.
Well, and also, I mean, if you want to mention Microsoft, this is very similar to the Department of Justice's suits against Microsoft in the late 90s, claiming the same thing, dominant market share used to promote a new market in the browser. And that's exactly what the EU is saying is, because Google has market share of 90%, they are using their position in search to force people to use Google in the Android operating system, force Google is the default search in the Android operating system. The Play Store accounts for 90% of apps downloaded on Android devices. So manufacturers have to, you know, for commercial reasons, pre-install the Play Store. And for that reason, Android users are less likely to use other stores. So the commission...
although that's confusing, right? Because that's part of what...
it's called success,
say,
if you ask me.
Well, they
me,
say it's but... 90% of Android devices, but are they talking about Android devices, or are they talking about Android open source project devices? And when they say Android in that instance, to say 90%,
they're saying
they probably
the
mean
licensed
both.
Android devices. Oh, really? Oh, interesting.
No, they probably mean both, because you're not going to be a licensed Android device without having Google Play
right,
on it. It's
right.
part of the licensing process.
The commission seeks to ensure, they say, that manufacturers are free to choose which apps they pre-install on their devices. Mm-hmm. Although, just as with Microsoft, consumer choice has always existed. But it's the tyranny of the default, because Google Search is the default, Google Browser is the default.
Although interestingly here, it's like, I could just go on a rant about this whole thing.
Go ahead. Do it, Danny. Do it.
So, first of all, we have to start off like, there's no question Google is dominant in search, all right? And so Google is vulnerable and has already had actions against it in search because it has such a dominance. And you can do the arguments of like, well, other people do different things or whatever, but you know, it's widely accepted that when you have dominance in a particular market, if you have a monopoly, it's not necessarily illegal to have the monopoly, but it's that you may have special circumstances that you have to follow to ensure that there's competition. So Google at 90% in search is already vulnerable in Europe that it needs to do special things. And certainly the EU ruled that when it came to regular search. But then they start trying to go into, well, now how can we try to somehow curtail them in search when it comes to Android? And so they do this bizarre thing of saying, well, they have like 90% of the licensed mobile operating system market. And it's like, what? Like 90, they don't, you don't pay Google, unless I'm missed it somewhere, you don't pay Google a licensing fee. Google doesn't make money directly off of you becoming an Android provider. And anybody could be a licensed thing, but they've provided Android and said, here's this platform, you want to use it, you can use it. You want to actually call it Android as a trademark, then it's going to be licensed Android and you have to install this Google stuff. But still, you know, you don't have to do it. You can go out and buy your own thing. But so this product that no one actually has to buy, suddenly they say, well, you have a monopoly of this free product
yeah.
people use, so now we want to restrict it more because manufacturers should be able to do what they want, right? But Apple doesn't have any of these restrictions, right? There's no argument in here that says, well, Apple shouldn't be able to shove Watch on its device or shove right. podcast down right. your throat or shove Pages down your throat or shove any of the other Apple crap it wants to on iOS that you cannot install, because apparently if you're the manufacturer of a device, you can do whatever the hell you want. But if you are this bizarre majority licensee of this third-party thing that we don't even make money off of and nobody has to use it, but they decide to use it anyway because they're too lazy to build their Cynogen or whatever the hell you want to call it type of operating system and do it, well, then we're going to say, well, no, that's bad, because pre-bundling is bad because manufacturers should be able to do what they want, because manufacturers may want to shove their own crap down somebody's throat rather than yours crap down the throat, even though they didn't build the thing, so we're going to do
wait
this.
A minute, and I agree with you, but I'm going to – but wait a minute, because one of the things the commissioner is saying is that when you and consumers want it, pre-install Google's proprietary apps on your version of Android, as part of the licensing agreement, Google says you have to sign an anti-fragmentation agreement and commit not to sell devices running on Android forks. You can't sell AOSP if you're going to sell a licensed version. So Samsung can't do both a Google... you know, Play Store version and then one without, like, by the way, Amazon does, because they call it their anti-fragmentation agreement. The EU says, well, that's proof that Google's forcing manufacturers into using its market share and demand from consumers into its proprietary corner.
Right.
Which, you know, but I agree with you, because Google did the right thing, which was they made an open source operating system that anybody could use. They offered Google services as you know, a come on. Maybe they should drop this anti-fragmentation agreement. I think that is kind of
There's a lot of things that they could do. I mean, I agree with you on the anti. When they started doing that, because a lot of this is coming back to haunt Google for its own two-faced talking on Android. First, Android's open source and anybody can use it. Then it turns out Android's is not open source, anybody can use it. Android, if you want to call it Android, means you have to do all this licensing stuff to get the Android trademark. Otherwise, you can't call it Android, which is why Apple stuff does not call it, which is why the Amazon devices don't call themselves Android, because they're not Android. You know,
now Kindle is not Android. Under the surface. We know that, but it's not Android.
Right.
Branded Android.
So they started doing this stuff where it was like, well, everybody should get together because open is always good, because that's Google's go-to thing whenever they're behind on something. Well, we'll declare it open.
But let me defend them.
Open's a better thing. But then once they get the dominance in an area, open is no longer open anymore. And now we're in this bizarre world where, well, Android is open, but it's not open because we do this licensing, but you don't have to do it. You can do this stuff over here. So on the one hand, they've confused it. On the other hand, yeah, the EU is coming back being just as confusing with the whole thing. And, you know.
And by the time this is all resolved, it'll be probably moot as it was with Microsoft.
Yeah.
And you have this, and then you have this stupid browser ballot for 10 more years. It just confuses the hell out of people and serves no real purpose.
Well, and that's exciting, too, because let's just jump ahead and talk about, all right, let's say you come up with your solution, and the solution, the main thing that they're pushing here is they don't like search being shoved down. They don't like Google search being shoved through Android, right? That's been the main thing that they put in here. So let's do a ballot box of search providers you have to have in the EU. Okay.
Nobody wants that.
But let's.
That, what is the choice?
What they want.
Bing?
Your choice will be
Yahoo,
Google, Bing.
And Bing.
Well, in France, they wanted
and then,
mandate.
And then
that's right. France has their own, don't they, Mike?
Yeah, France wants a mandate in addition to alternatives to Google that you have a French search engine. In other news, there's a French search engine.
Here's the thing: France did have a French search engine, and it was called name that I can't remember, but it was a homegrown search engine. They ended up letting it sold to AOL. I'll see if I can find the name with it from there. So, but even if you do that search engine, there's an excellent chance that some of these other search engines will end up being powered by Google.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, like, DuckDuckGo is still Google, right?
Yeah.
Is DuckDuckGo Google, or is it a hodgepodge of other stuff?
DuckDuckGo, I think it's Google. I think is Bing, actually.
Oh, it's Bing? But a sanitized, whatever it is, it's a sanitized version, so there's no information about your searches fed back to the origin. Because they don't have their own crawler yet. They're working on one.
And that's the thing when you start changing around search engines. By the way, the French search engine, the French private search engine is Quant. And I think they actually
Quant,
do.
That's right.
I think they actually do run their own crawling, because I remember talking with one of the principals on it last year when I was out in France. But here's the real problem.
Nobody wants anything but Google, because Google's is better than all these alternatives. So the customers.
Especially in Europe.
Yeah.
European public loves Google more than any other public.
That's why they have 90% market share.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it'll give some of these other providers a better chance, and it'll give them maybe the ability to actually make a serious go of it if they really wanted to, because right now, why would you? I mean, seriously, why would you think I'm going to try to compete with Google? Because to build up that kind of an infrastructure that you need to crawl the web as the core part of competing with them is difficult. And then to try to capture the market share, like, you need some degree of market share to go with it, right? So this kind of thing could benefit some of those companies, and it might not be bad. I mean, it's nice to have competition in search. It's nice to have Google feel like there's things that they need to be stepped up. And so, you know, going back to, you know, the idea that there's a 90% thing, they probably could have just said enough that you have a 90% share and we're going to impose this on Android anyway, right? But when they come in with all this other bizarre stuff, like, and of course, you know, you're the dominant third-party licensing provider, and you're like, what? You didn't even need to do that. And then your argument is just weird.
Quant, by the way. You can use Quant, Quant.com. You can use it in the United States. They show you hot trends, Donald Trump, Elizabeth II, IHOP, and Chrissy Teigen's bus line. Let's search for something. Let's search for, what should we search for? Mike Elgin. Let's see if they know about you. Yeah. Look at, is that you, Mike, in the sailor suit?
That's a picture. That's a picture of my dad. Where did they get that? It's my dad in the Navy.
But at least, you know what? It did a good job. It found a lot of Mike Elgin. Your food and technology podcast, articles by Mike Elgin on Computer World, Facebook, LinkedIn. Pretty good
that's
job.
I'm switching.
Huh?
I'm switching.
You're well known in France. Here's videos. Look at that. Oh, there's
mostly,
one.
Mostly Twit stuff.
It's all Twit stuff. Well, you don't do videos, right? Let's see. Danny Sullivan. I guess you could. I just don't see a lot of people wanting to use Quant, even in France, probably, right? There you are. Oh, of course, I found the race car driver. Mm-hmm. But you're mixed in with a race car driver.
Just had his anniversary.
Did he really?
Well, they had some F1. I know this because people were congratulating me on Twitter.
You're kind of inextricably entwined now for the rest of your lives.
Yeah, I know.
I just look at what the EU did with cookies, and I feel like that's a really good example of how all of this is really going to end up with something that makes no one happy, solves no problem.
There's nothing as enjoyable than every time I go to a website having to shut that damn window telling me there's this cookie.
Yeah, and what did it accomplish?
You really did a great job there. Good for you.
Yeah. I mean, if people are listening and don't understand what we're talking about.
Meanwhile, when I'm watching Sky TV and I change the channel, Sky doesn't tell me every time I go to a channel. And by the way, we're monitoring everything you watch, right. And we may use that for however we want.
Right. It's insane. When you go to sites, nowadays every site, because if you want to do business in Europe, you have to do this. There's a big banner the first time you visit that says, hey, we use cookies. Is that okay? Yeah, that's okay. Click that. It's just annoying. It doesn't solve any problem. Costs money to implement.
Sometimes it feels like the EU is just hyper-conservative about anything. Any sort of new business model, any sort of new thing, they just like, wait a minute, we can't have a new thing. I mean, to a very large extent, if you take a 10,000-foot view of Google's business model around Android, it's just a different business model. Yes, we gain dominant market share by giving away this great operating system on all these phones. And the business model is we get the manufacturers to bundle these apps, people launch the apps, and we make money from advertising. That's just the business model. They don't like that business model because it doesn't match or map against anything that is understood or well known. But it seems like a pretty straightforward business model. The OEMs are in a position where they can choose alternatives.
Samsung phone has prioritized the Samsung browser, not Chrome. They do use Google as a search, but if they didn't, I would immediately change it anyway. So.
But the companies that do try to do innovative things with CyanogenMod and all these other things with the exception of maybe Amazon, alternative user interfaces and so on, they're routinely rejected by the public who say we want virgin vanilla right. Android. That's what we want.
Yeah.
Well, no, but I mean the biggest selling Android device you have right now is from Samsung, unless I'm off the mark.
I'm sure it's the S7 outside of China,
right?
Yeah.
And there's no way that's a pure device. It's full of crap.
It's the number one in terms of the second biggest one, but in terms of a market share, it's a tiny percentage.
Right. But Danny, it's less full of crap than ever. In other words, they're feeling market pressure to tone down TouchWiz.
My Verizon phone.
That's Verizon. That's not Samsung. I agree with you on that. Verizon loads it up with crap.
My Verizon iPhone does not have that crap on it.
No, well, Apple had some remarkable market clout that probably has dwindled somewhat.
But I do think it's very easy to be in the U.S. and just go, oh, those Europeans are crazy. They just hate all innovation, blah, 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 blah. I do think that there are, you know, some serious concerns they have that Google's market share in search is much higher than in the U.S., right? There really is no alternative out there that people are using. And that raises obvious concerns to begin with. You have those concerns about anything that happens regardless when something's that, especially when it comes to how people seek information.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, Facebook had to say, despite what Mark Zuckerberg said at F8 against Donald Trump, we're not going to try to throw the election. And the fact that they had to say that shows that people are aware of the clout that Facebook and Google, the dominant players have.
I think you have that.
I mean,
well, how long before Facebook does decide they
wants Google?
Right.
And the fact that Google is far less dominant in other regions, other countries, proves that if they wanted alternatives, they would choose those alternatives. Well, those alternatives are freely available.
A lot of the European countries and people do want Google, but I think that you actually have a significant number of people in Europe. I'm not saying the majority, but I think a significant number of people who have serious concerns about the only search tool that I have is this thing that I have concerns about what's going on with my privacy and my tracking, and it's tied into my phone. And maybe I don't want to use Google, but how do I get to a good alternative to that? Because I think the privacy concerns in the EU are much higher, in public concerns. And then I think you have to add on top of the fact that there's a political aspect to this, both among people and among the politicians that are reacting to it or leading it, which is, you know, Google's an American company. And you've got this American company with this big, huge dominance that's out there. And do we like that? That it's that kind of. And I think if you flipped it around and if you were told that the largest search engine in America was owned by China and a Chinese company, you might have some people who would have concerns about it or being worried about it. It might be thinking, well, maybe there's other things we need to. Maybe we need to address this, and maybe we need to address it on the antitrust ground type of things. And then there's no doubt that there's going to be politicians that see this as a way for them to score. They don't, you know, sorry, but, you know, European politicians are any different than American politicians, where sometimes they're doing stuff because they think it's the right thing to do, and sometimes they're doing stuff because it's the right thing for them to score a big victory in what they're doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of messy, but, you know, I don't think you can entirely dismiss what the EU is doing as it's just all ridiculous. I think they've got some serious concerns, especially with some of these licensing agreements that Google ties into Android. But I do think some of the other stuff and how they try to position it seem to be very laughable. And I guess that's what concerns me the most, is that do you really think it's an issue that manufacturers should be able to put whatever they want on their phones? Or is it really that your concern is that when manufacturers can't put what they want, that doesn't help users, which in turn helps competition? And then if that's the concern, then really what you ought to be doing is addressing default installations on any device. Like, I'd be cheering from the roof if the EU said right now, you know what? Nobody who makes a cell phone can force you to have applications stay on that phone.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
The consumer has a right to uninstall and pick and choose and put whatever they want on it. And moreover, you need to make it really clear when you tell somebody that you're going to set something as a default why you're doing it. So if Apple wants to make sure that Spotlight is by default going over to Bing, you know, you understand that. And in addition to that, you understand that they're doing it because they're getting paid a crap load of money to make it happen. That's one of the things I actually wrote to the FTC here in the U.S. about 3 years ago. You know, I sent a formal letter saying, we have these deals in the U.S. They happen, and the consumers have no idea why they're happening and who's paying whom for what going on. And maybe you ought to be looking at how that kind of disclosure happens, but they don't care. So,
one other dimension to this that I think bears pointing out is that it feels oftentimes like the EU is always complaining about American tech companies. But the reality is that it's mostly American tech companies complaining to the EU, who then respond to those American companies by going after the other American companies. That's mostly the dynamic in all of these stories.
You're just a pawn in your game. Well, you know, there's some merit to what the EU says, and I think Google's smartest thing Google could do at this point would be to respond, to attempt to settle. They have a few weeks to do so. I think 4 months, 3 or 4 months to do that. And of course, maybe what their response has been, the UC Davis strategy, as Danny Sullivan called it, to release a bunch of news today so that it would be buried in the Google search results.
But, I mean, they might just decide to drag it out as long as they can, because, yeah, as you say, the longer you drag it out, the more that by the time you get to a requirement in the settlement, the more it may not make any deal difference.
Right. Exactly. Hey, what happened? By the way, we've lost Jeff Jarvis. He had to bow out because the quality of his connection in Germany was so bad that he couldn't weigh in. He'd have to respond 30 seconds later, and that wasn't going to work. But I'm really glad we still have Mike in Mexico, in Cancun, and Danny Sullivan from Orange County. What's the story with the Google Transparency Report? Because yesterday, when I went to the safe browsing site status and searched for Google.com, it said somewhat dangerous. Now it's not dangerous. Talk about transparency. Did they just change their settings, or was it a mistake when they said they were somewhat dangerous?
You know, my guess it was some kind of a glitch. I mean, you remember once Google blocked I think in Google search results, they blocked all of Google or something for a period. Remember, there was that period of time when suddenly everybody had to use Yahoo, and they had this big spike off of it. So, you know, glitches happen.
These things happen. It must have been a little embarrassing.
I don't think they went through and deliberately said, oh, we're bad, just go change it.
Or we're not bad.
I suspect that if there was something that was wrong, they figured out what it was and then tried to fix it.
Well, and it does say some pages
they
on this website. Well, it's the actual site safety details don't appear to have changed. Some pages on this website install malware on visitors' computers. That's because it's a search engine. So you may search to sites that do that. Some pages on this website redirect visitors to dangerous websites, including Google Groups. Dangerous websites have been sending visitors to this website. So people link to Google.com, and that's considered a black mark. So none of that has changed. Just the overall status, which is now not dangerous from somewhat dangerous. So I think there's a little
status. Oh, they're not dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. Not mostly harmless would be nice.
It was 2009. I've got the TechCrunch article. We had one as well, but it was like Google flags whole internet as malware. So it was
not
like
far wrong.
Whenever you searched on Google, every site on Google,
I remember saying,
that this may harm your computer. And it really helped Yahoo that day. They got a significant rise. So yeah, stuff happens.
Again, not far wrong. I think the internet is pretty much a malware haven. I think we can move on to less controversial topics, new things. Well, unless you want to say, if you want to talk about the article, why I won't live in Google Alphabet's tech utopia.
Because it doesn't exist yet. And even if it did exist, you don't even know what would be in it.
This is based on that weird article that Google, that Alphabet wants to build a city.
You felt like you should write a clickbait article anyway. So
so this is clickbait based on clickbait.
Also, why will not live in heaven?
Next. Although, to be honest, if Google Alphabet did build a city, I would move into it in a heartbeat. Right? Well, who wouldn't want to?
You know what? I bet that if they're like giving you a free house and everything, you might be like, I should think, I'd live there.
It would have high-speed internet. It would have autonomous vehicles. It would have green roofs. This comes from
and ads everywhere.
It would have,
mini kitchens.
There's a price to be paid. Yeah, no kitchens because you're going to eat out every night. This comes from the Recode. You say, Danny, that this Recode article in the first place was clickbait.
No, that one's not.
Oh, okay.
Because that's a report that's actually a report off of the Alphabet article, right?
Right.
So that's like, here they're planning to do this thing. We don't really know much about it, but to me it's like, why I won't live in this thing we barely know anything about.
So it all goes back to exclusive piece in the information by Jessica Lesson. Alphabet Sidewalk Labs is considering not a city, but a futuristic district, Project Sidewalk. They've been working with 100 advisors on a plan for a standalone digital district, which would mark one of the most high-profile attempts at a dedicated technology testbed. Please, Google, if you're listening, I volunteer. You got to have some old people. Can't all be millennials living there. Somebody's got to slow traffic down by crossing the street at a snail's pace. I volunteer.
This is kind of the original intention of Epcot Center, which if you look at the old videos of Walt Disney rolling out the vision, what they ended up with was very different from what they intended to, and partly because Walt Disney died. But
last time I was at Epcot, I took a picture of the telephone booth of the future. This is an alternative future that I think is not going to happen. That's why it's so hard to predict the future, because I think nobody would have predicted, maybe somebody would have, the ascendance of the pocket computer and its ubiquity and its total addictive nature. I don't think anybody really knew that was coming 10 years ago, let alone 50.
I think Google should buy an existing town like Detroit
Why not?
Put Hyperloop transportation, flying.
Elon needs to buy it with Google.
They did have that contest where some town renamed themselves Google or something.
Yeah, but that was to get Google with fiber. Yeah. It didn't work, by the way. They didn't get it. Do you think they named themselves back?
I'm sure they can come up with a I'm sure they can come up with a city to buy here or there.
Made in New York in our chat room is suggesting that Google's prototype community of tomorrow should be called Goopcut.
Goopcut. I like that. That's good.
I'm moving to Goopcut. Mike Elgin, he was living in the country of the past. He's now moved to the Middle Ages in the Yucatan Peninsula. Where are you going after this? Do you know?
We're leaning toward Europe, France, and the UK. As boring and delicious as that sounds, but yeah, we're not sure right now.
Nice?
Cancun is actually a great place because it's a hub to the Caribbean, to South America. Yeah. We have a couple of trips planned coming back to the United States as well. So, who knows? Could be just about anywhere. We'll be here for at least a couple of months.
I'm so damn jealous. I'm just really. Yeah. I'm happy for you because at least somebody gets to do that. So much more to talk about. Let's take a break and come back with more, and then we can talk about Facebook's frustrating and useless chatbots. I haven't talked to you about F8 and chatbots yet, Mike, so I'm curious what your take is on all of this.
Okay, I can't wait to tell you.
Can't wait to find out. Our show today brought to you by Automatic. Love my Automatic. Got one right here. See, turns out every car, not in Cuba, you can't use this in Cuba, but every car built since 1996 has a OBD or onboard diagnostic port right under the steering wheel. It's open. It's available. It's not illegal to plug into it. I think most of us just look at it and go, oh, that's for the technician when he's going to, you know, fix my car. But, you know, it can be used for a lot more. When you attach the automatic, suddenly you've got the quantified car. This just plugs right into it. And it integrates with so many things. You get real-time performance data. So the first thing you do is install the automatic app on your phone, Android or iOS. It pairs via Bluetooth. And now you're going to get all sorts of performance data. You can actually look at the temperature of your engine as you're driving. You can get audio alerts signaling that you've stepped on the gas too hard, or you're braking too hard, or you're going too fast. That helps you become a better driver, a more efficient driver, too. Their commute analyzer determines when you should leave for your destination and how you could save money by making your commute more efficient. Seeing how much a drive to the store cost in gasoline is really great, and it's real time. It's based on where you got gas last and the amount of gas your engine's using. It's really accurate. The dashboard web app provides granular information, lets you export trips, and then you could tie it into other things. So I have it automatically, for instance, via if this then that, porting out my every trip to an Evernote notebook, keeping track of where I go, and it has the map, it has the distance, has information about how I drove, a score associated with it. It also works with the Amazon Echo. Yeah, it's so cool. You can ask the automatic how much gas is in my tank. Nest, so it can turn the thermostat up when you're on your way home. Your Mechanic, so you can figure out what those lights mean on the dashboard. It'll work with FreshBooks and Expensify and Concur, so you can keep track of business mileage automatically. And if you have a teenager, this is the best thing you can get. They have apps that will integrate to help your teenager be a better driver and help you keep track of what your teenager's doing in your car. They've even got 24/7 crash response, so you can feel secure knowing Automatic is keeping you and your loved ones safe at all times on the road. Apple Watch and Pebble integration as well. And none of this requires a monthly fee. You just have to buy the automatic. Normally, that's $99.95, but we have a special offer code, TWIT, T-W-I-T. They'll save you 20%. Automatic.com/TWIT. And use the offer code TWIT to save 20% off the regular purchase price. I got two. I got one for Lisa and one for me. I love the automatic. Automatic.com/TWIT. And if you follow my Chief Twit Bot on Twitter or on Telegram, that's how I give you the notifications. When I pull up out front, you'll get a notification. Leo has pulled up. That's using if this then that, and it knows when I've turned off my ignition within a certain area on the map, and tweets for me, and posts to the Telegram bot. I love that kind of thing. It's all the sky's the limit. Automatic.com/twit. Mike Elgin is here. He's visiting us again from his jaunts around the world. Danny Sullivan from Search Engine Land as well. Let's talk about F8. Were you able to see any of the F8 conference, Mike, or read about it?
No way.
Yeah.
not from Cuba, but I read all about it when I got back.
Yeah.
You know, I was a huge cheerleader for bots when they first came out. I was, as you know, I think it was on this show maybe a month and a half ago that I recommended X.AI, which has got the Amy bot that interacts via email and so on. But what's bothering me about the whole bot hype thing is the degree to which it's being viewed as an alternative to apps. Companies are frustrated because their app is hard to discover, and even if people install it, they forget about it. It's hard to get make an app that's both discovered and sticky. And they're saying that bots are the solution because you don't have to install anything. It's just there. You just chat and so on. The problem is that I think bots are going to be, in aggregate, far worse than apps. Individually, if you just look at the 1-800-Flowers bot, you think, oh, I could order, you know, I just want a dozen roses sent to my mother on Mother's Day. Okay, that sounds like a good application for a bot. But what happens when all the florists are on and there are dozens of thousands of bots? How do you find them? How do you remember to use them?
And everyone you use is now kind of sending you spam messages, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the flawed logic behind the hype around bots is that, hey, everybody's doing messaging. So that's where the eyeballs are. We'll just go to where the eyeballs are and then we'll succeed because that's where everybody is. That's flawed logic because people go to messaging because it's free of spam, because it's free of visuals and complexity and hype and marketing. And once that starts being asserted on the chat platforms and the messaging apps, if users can't do anything about it, they'll just wander away to some other medium. It'll ruin messaging as a friendly medium. I just don't see how bots are going to... It's essentially going back to a command line interface. You have to know the command to launch the right
there's
kind
buttons.
Of bot.
Bots have buttons so that you know that. I mean, the buttons are going to be critical. But I have to say, I had the CNN bot on for a while and I turned it off. It just was annoying. There's a great article, Katie Natopoulos writing in BuzzFeed, 6 things that definitely sucked about Facebook's new shopping bot. She just wanted some shoes and it kept trying to upsell her. She said it was kind of like that annoying salesperson who's saying, oh, you look great in this. She said, I want sneakers under $100. It offered her $500 sneakers. These are a bit more expensive at $120, but I think they're really great for summer. It even said things like, you know, I think this is really, really a great looking shoe. And she's saying, who? A bot? How do you know? Do you have feet? The whole thing is really annoying. No customer reviews. She says, I asked the bot to tell me the customer rating for a pair of sunglasses. It replied, they don't have reviews yet, but, quote, we hear good things. From whom, I might ask? From whom? Your bot friends? And furthermore, you have to enter your credit card. It doesn't, for reasonable reasons, it doesn't save your Facebook, even though Facebook knows all sorts of things, including... if you've signed up for things like the Facebook Pay feature and messaging your credit card, that won't use it, though. So you have to, this is a good interface, manually enter your credit card number into the messaging. That's gonna go well.
So I'm more positive, although first I have to say, Leo, that was such a good pitch. I just ordered one of those automatic things.
Did you? They're good. Oh, you're going to love it. They're so cool.
You're going on, and I'm going, that sounds fantastic.
Oh, it is. Ads. So- Will they never stop working?
Has to be in a, that's a great pitch.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Stay tuned. I'll have other things for you to buy later.
So on the bot thing, I was Mr. Dubious about this whole thing. And I totally agree with Mike. And I do feel that there's so much hype and this idea that that the bots are going to replace apps is going to work just as well as the way that the apps replaced the web, which, of course, they didn't. And in reality, I think that these are all layered. You know, sometimes using the mobile web is going to make sense for you, and you're going to continue to do it, and it's great. And sometimes using an app is going to make sense, and it's, you know, you're dealing with one person enough that you're like, yeah, like for my gym, I, you know, if I could book a training session or whatever, they've got a great app. It's really easy. I use that rather than try to call them or go online or whatever, because the app is great. So I'm going to use their app. But I think that the bots have a place, and you know that there are things that they can do. And I did my own article, and it was like how I sent flowers to Mark Zuckerberg using a bot.
Wow, that's right. I was supposed to ask you about that. You did that during the speech.
Well, it wasn't during the speech. I wish it was that good.
Oh, okay.
No, actually, afterwards, I was at F8, and afterwards, I wandered around, looked at different things, and I sat down. I thought, all right, I've heard a lot about bots over the past 4 months or so, but I've never really kind of interacted with one because I don't use messaging much, and there hasn't been that many of them. So let me go try one of these things out. So I, you know, for whatever reason, I started off with the flower bot. This is 1-800-Flowers one. And I came away with the belief, like, that bot is so good that when Mother's Day comes around, I will use it to buy the flowers, because it was actually a better experience than going to the website, which I have done before.
Huh.
It was very easy. And one of the nicest things about it was, like, you know, you can complain about putting in, you know, your credit card number or whatever. But like, I needed to send the flowers and I couldn't remember the whole address. And as I was going through, I thought, well, let me pretend to send flowers to Mark. Why not? Because let's see how this whole thing works. And so it was like, well, what's the address? And I'm like, well, I know it's One Hacker Way, but I don't know the rest. I put that in and it's like, do you mean One Hacker Way, Menlo Park, California, 92, whatever, whatever, whatever. I'm like, yeah. And then it gave me a selection of flowers. And as you'll see, you know, if you've read my article, like, they weren't exactly what I was looking for. Like, I didn't really want to send them love and romance flowers. But, you know, I found something that was, you know, like, that works. And it's a good price range. And there was enough selections for what I needed to do. And it wasn't going to be anything that great if I'd gone to the website as well. And it was like a 5-minute process. And because I wasn't on the web, and even if it was on a mobile web or an app, you're still sometimes like, okay, I got to put it in here. And, you know, to entering my credit card number, it saved it. It went through pretty straightforward. I was a believer. And in fact, after I sent the flowers to Mark and then I wrote the article about and I posted the article, 2 minutes later, my wife was like, yeah, you know, I like flowers if you're sending them to Mark. So I went back and I sent her flowers. Like strawberries more than flowers. But I did it again, and I did it all from the chatbot, and it worked great. And so, like I said, Mother's Day will roll around. So I think that for certain instances, you might find that these things are useful. Now, I'm totally with a lot of these things. I went back and played with that same shopping app, and it was like, yeah, it was a miserable experience. I mean, and it may
I guess we have to acknowledge, just as with any other technology, it's early days, and so it's a mixed bag, right?
And some things will work. The poncho, I think
poncho is so annoying.
Yeah, and I think Facebook kind of did themselves a disservice because they really wanted to make this a big announcement. Yes. And when you go in and, you know, if you go into your phone and you're in Messenger now and you start to do a search for stuff, it's offering these five chatbots, only one of which I found worked really well.
CNN was terrible. Poncho, yeah. Hi, Poncho, the weather bot is singularly annoying. I mean, it's almost as if you pick. So, in fact, there's a great article. This is in Gizmodo by Darren Orff, in which he does some screenshots, if you don't want to turn on Poncho, at how annoying Poncho can be. Do I need a jacket? Yep, it's chilly. Sunglasses? Sorry, I was trying to charge my phone. What are you trying to say?
When you turn on your phone and it's like, here's the weather.
Yeah, you can see the weather. Instead of getting this really annoying hipster, your future's so bright, got to wear shades. What about an umbrella? Excuse me? Do I need an umbrella? And then what's the weather like this weekend? Are you on a boat? Because I was not able to find any results for that location. What's the weather like in Brooklyn this weekend? He finally gave up and said, I'll tell you where I am. The weather in Brooklyn, New York is 46 degrees and clear. This weekend? Excusez-moi? Weekend. Sorry, dozed off for a second. What were you saying? Like, you don't want that in your phone. I got family members like that. I don't need to sign up for a bot.
But this points to the three things that are going to make bots amazing. And unfortunately, these three things are 5 years away.
Uh-huh.
So the first thing is real artificial intelligence. We have to get to the point where computers can understand random things like
this is
umbrella.
Artificial stupidity.
It needs to say, oh, he's asking me if I need to recommend an umbrella. So you need real AI to manage, not in each and in every individual bot, but a referee, sort of a platform that referees all that manages all this stuff. It could be the chat app. Okay. The second thing is you need the app itself needs to have all the data. It needs to know who my mother is. It needs to know what everybody's address, like Amazon, the kind of information Amazon has.
But doesn't Facebook already know that?
Well, they should. The third thing is that I think the real killer app of this is voice interaction. So
I agree.
Typing messaging, I think, is okay, but we really just want to talk. And if you can imagine the integration of Siri, Cortana, Alexa, and so on, as the manager of all these third-party apps, bots, excuse me, and can intelligently choose those. So let me give you a real, the flowers example that Danny's talking about is one of the best current examples for how bots work. But here's how it should really work. You talk to the bot, you talk to Siri or Cortana, and you say, or Google Now, and you say, I want to send flowers to Mark Zuckerberg. And the bot should come back and say, you know, I've noticed through your past purchase that you like organic foods and organic things. There is a small shop in Mark Zuckerberg's town that sells organic flowers. It's only a couple of dollars more than the cheapest flowers around. Would you like to consider flowers from that? Yes, I would. Okay, so here it is, blah, blah, blah. You know, that kind of intelligence will make this amazing, life-changing. But for now, we're going to be struggling against this, the stupidity of AI, the inability of it to know anything. The data for all these products have not been keyed in and optimized for bots. So the world is not ready for bots yet. The AI is not ready for bots yet. And I don't think the public is going to be thrilled with all this frustration. So I think that for the next year, there's going to be a lot of I think bots will kind of unfortunately be a little bit of a laughing stock because people will have so many frustrating experiences like the ones that you talked about.
Yeah, but it's early days yet. And I think there's potential there. I think we don't even really fully understand what bots are best for, how they could be best used. And I think you're exactly right. AI is nowhere near as good as it is. And I finally got the Amazon Dot, which is I'm a fan of the Echo, big fan, own four of them.
Yeah.
But the Echo speaker is kind of mediocre, and I would like to have the Echo be able to do things like play me music and read me books in a way that sounds a little bit better. So the Dot is a speakerless, or almost. It has a small, function utility speaker, but it's basically a speakerless version. It's the top of the Echo cut off, and I paired it to a Bluetooth speaker, which seemed to be the best way, better than plugging it in hardwired, because it didn't seem to wake it up all the time, things like that. But Bluetoothed it, put the Echo near where I am. The speaker is playing loud. It's great. It's always there, always available. And when the Echo suddenly has full stereo sound, rich stereo sound, it's just remarkable. And I really think that is a platform that is, and it's a let's face it, that's a chatbot essentially.
It is, and it's doing what I'm talking about. They have what they call skills. Third-party developers, yep, and Amazon was very aggressive with this, built these skills. But it also has the problem that I was talking about, which is in order to use a specific skill, you have to have skill yourself. You have to know, well, what's the command specifically that will enable that skill? It's a for one or two skills, it's fine. If you want to use a dozen or two dozen or three dozen of those skills that are available on Amazon Echo, it's like, there's a lot of homework to do to figure out. Remember really how
needs,
to do it.
It really needs to be smart enough. Because I was going through to add some skills, and there are like 10 pages of different things.
It really needs to
be smart enough to know that when I tell it something, that it goes, right, and just finds the skill and runs the skill rather than, do you want to install it?
I think
so
that'll
happen. If I say, Alexa, fart, I need it to just immediately fart.
Would you like me to install the fart skill? And then tell you what the syntax is. So from now on, you need to say it this way. That'll happen.
See, but I don't want to do that. That's going to be a real leap for it, too, because I don't want to actually have to remember the syntax. It should figure that stuff out.
Well, that's another failing of natural language right now. It's not very good. Good article in Bloomberg, although unaccountably loaded with dancing GIFs. Can we just talk about the layout on this? I don't know what they're trying to accomplish, but it's everything but Punch the Monkey. But it is on the, did somebody get a GIF animating program at Bloomberg and decide, you know what this article needs is more dancing echoes. It's the strangest thing. the real story of how Amazon built the Echo. Of course, it's in Amazon's Lab 126 where the Fire Phone was built. It was originally created to build the Kindle. And it was one of, I think it was Project D or E. They do them in the alphabet. The one before it was augmented reality, apparently. The team somehow was doing something along the lines of a voice response system. Jeff Bezos didn't really think much of it, but they went ahead. Some have reported that that's one of the issues at Amazon, is that you spend a lot of energy, way too much energy, thinking about whether Jeff will like it, and doing more things probably than you would. Project C was an augmented reality program of some kind, which died. Project D ended up being the Echo, despite Bezos' suspicion of the whole thing. It's a good article, well-researched, if you can ignore it. I think this is a good one for Pocket. Just put it in Pocket or readability, and you won't see the animated.
Well, one little bit of trivia that I didn't know, and I thought I knew everything about Amazon and Lab 126, was that 126 is a reference to the alphabet, one representing the letter A and 26 representing the letter Z. And I thought, I always wondered what that 126 was all about.
They also talked about the name and the wake up, because apparently Bezos wanted it to be Amazon, and his engineers were saying, you can't. Because it'll wake up all the time. People say Amazon a lot on TV, everywhere, sometimes not even referring to us. And so they want it to be A-L-E-X-A, which is much less commonly referred to. Jeff resisted, but eventually I think...
They should just let you make it whatever you want, though. I want the hot word to be the hot word I want it to be.
Yeah, the only time I've ever seen that is in the Moto X, where you could create your own... And I guess it's because it uses too much processor power to have arbitrary words, right? You want to have just a few patterns built in.
And still, come on.
I know. Well, we got a long way to go, right?
Save the processing locally. Overwrite the RAM.
Do something.
The ROM. Do that.
Make it better. And then there's people in Cuba who don't have water for 4 days. I just want to remind you.
Yeah.
Although I have the feeling that Cubans would rather have good internet connectivity than water.
Isn't that interesting? That just shows you how much I think you're right. I think once people really get experience of the internet, the world changes. It's a different world we live in.
Google set up this I know we talked a lot about Cuba earlier, but one last thing I have to mention.
Yeah.
Google partnered with an artist whose name is Cacho, K-C-H-O. And set up a room at Cacho's, sort of an art compound. And this artist does lots and lots of things to get young people involved in art and culture and so on. And this partnership with Cuba has 20 Chromebooks set up. And these Chromebooks are on a super fast Wi-Fi that's supposedly 70 times faster than the government Wi-Fi. It's literally the fastest internet in Cuba. I don't know how Google does this stuff. How they provide super fast connectivity in a place that just doesn't have it anywhere else. But they also had Google Cardboard there, and they also had free Wi-Fi, which is the only place in Cuba where you can actually use Wi-Fi for free. And what's fascinating about it is people were lining up to use those fast Chromebooks. Nobody was paying attention to Cardboard, because Cardboard, I'm sure they all tried it. Oh, this is really neat. They really just want to get online. And man, you get 1 hour with this fast Wi-Fi, and people were just locked into these screens for that hour. It was really something to see. They are so hungry for good internet.
Okay, we really take it for granted, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, just the fact that you can stream Game of Thrones or, you know, House of Cards. It's really remarkable. Really remarkable. And... couple of change log. I will do the change log, which is just going to be a bunch of new features. Google launched a bunch of new features today. And I think as Danny Sullivan said, it was to distract people from the EU decision. Google Play Music now, of course, has podcast support. It's on Android. It's on the web. We are on it. We are a big part of it. It's kind of rolling out slowly to Android. I don't yet have it on Android, but on the web, if you're a Google Play Music user, there will be now a new menu that says podcasts, and you can search for podcasts over here under the hamburger. You can search for podcasts, so you could search for Twit Or you can actually search for Twits, a way to see what all the shows we do, or you could search for individual shows as well. And I imagine most podcasts will be on here. I think the podcaster has to submit, just as they do with iTunes. So that may be a while, short while before your favorite podcast is on there. They've added new features to Inbox, which I just learned about because right before the show I checked TechMeme. And so I'm not really up on this. Maybe you are more, Danny. I like Google Inbox. In fact, we finally got Jeff Jarvis to use it. He fought it for a long time. Now it will keep track of events in your inbox and I think collate them.
Yeah, it puts all the email that you have
associated
around a specific event together. So sometimes if you have a trip coming up, you have the individual emails coming out over a period of weeks. It'll just group them all together nicely.
That's great. That's awesome. Email newsletters will have a preview, kind of rolling up all the issues into a single preview. You could store links that you want to remember with Save to Inbox. So I'm not sure. You have to get the, and I will get this, the Inbox by Gmail Chrome extension. And then now, I guess in Chrome, I can save it to my email. I don't understand.
It becomes an option in the share function on both Android and iOS. When you say, just hit the share, you can plug it in there so that, like saving a link or, you know.
Because Chrome has been missing this email link forever, right? Other browser, you just email a link. Doesn't seem like you can do that on Chrome unless I'm missing something. So now you add the Inbox extension. So what, it's just going to save it to my inbox?
Yeah, it'll create an item in the inbox. I love that because I use Inbox for everything. Any sort of information I want to retain, I just throw in an inbox and deal with it later. So that works great for me.
So and it also has another entry, share via email. So hallelujah, they finally added that. You'd think that would be a fundamental browser capability, but they finally added that. Google Fiber wants to beam wireless internet to your home, according to Recode. I guess this means, it makes sense because laying fiber is very costly. It was estimated that Verizon spent $5,000 per subscriber to give them Fios. So now it's looking at wireless high-speed internet, solving that expensive last-mile problem. I'll take it. Just point it my way. Point the beam at me. Let's see. Google claims YouTube ads are more effective than TV. Okay.
The TV people disagree.
I think some might disagree, but okay. Kevin Mark said this happened to him. The Marshmallow 6.01 update is bricking some people's Nexus 6s. So if you have an older Nexus 6, be careful about the April security patch. That's an over-the-air update. They don't bill them security patches, but that's what they are.
That's going to brick my Nexus 6?
Be careful. It does some, and it bricked Kevin Marks's Nexus 6.
How do I be careful? Do I just...
Don't take it. Don't take it. They do give you a chance. It's not an automatic install. There is a way to recover, according to somebody named Techno Bill. I trust him implicitly, which means you have to put the Android N beta on your Nexus 6. Check developer options. I don't know. It's complicated.
So I should just wait until that goes away and they unpush it.
I bet it's gone by now.
All right.
But I wouldn't wait. I would still wait.
I only update it like every 3 months or so. Anyway.
Whenever you know what, I see an Android update, I do it. I jump up and down. I think, maybe I'm getting nut roll. I don't know. I just get excited. I just can't wait. YouTube has rolled out support for 360-degree live streams, plus, and I think this is very important, spatial audio. So they've always had 360-degree videos, but this will be live now. Now, I don't know if you have hardware to do that. The cameras that do live 360-degree video are few and far between. So
this is like 8K video.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they can support it, but
who's going to do it?
Where is it and how do you watch it and where do you do it?
The other thing that'll be challenging too is that, you know, you have to be so careful with the 360 video. Like if you're like the first one I shot, I'm holding my phone, my thing up like this, right? And they realize, oh, great, this whole back part
is just your head. Right? Yeah. So, yeah.
You know, like what they were showing in their thing. Yeah, that's cool. But, you know, I suppose I don't know. It's 360 is awesome.
The 360 audio, though, I think is going to be a critical feature. And again, this requires hardware that has microphones in every direction. But that's kind of what you want. If you're looking over there, the sound should move, right?
Yeah.
So that's going to be a big deal. Again, I don't know what kind of hardware you're going to have to do it. But I suppose it's coming along. The Ozo, which is Nokia's camera, we were playing with that earlier. We made a couple of Ozo videos in the new screensavers and MacBreak Weekly with Alex Lindsay, who had one on loan. I think he has three Ozos at the NAB show. He's recording three 360-degree cameras, one of them on a moving jib. But they're $60,000 each. The problem is they're not live streaming. This is the video. This took him a week to generate this 10-minute video because it's 4 hours per minute of video to stitch it. 4 hours of processing for every minute of video you shoot. And you see, it doesn't even look all that good.
But that just changes everything.
Why? Oh, you're being sarcastic. Okay. Yeah.
Especially when you get it sent to you by your chatbot.
Yeah. Look. I think we've cool. got it all covered. Anything else you guys wanted? There was an interesting article about Magic Leap. In Wired, but as Nilay Patel writes in The Verge, in a critique of it, they didn't really ask the important questions in The Wired. It was a interesting profile, but here's the five burning questions Nilay Patel would like to know. What the hell is it?
It didn't answer anything.
It was mostly like a press release.
Magic Leak, and it was like,
it
I'm
just
sorry.
Works.
It was a nice article about what's going on with
and
VR.
Kevin Kelly, who wrote it, is great, and I love him.
Yeah, no, but I did not get inside Magic Leap. Like, I don't right. think we. I think somebody said we don't even see what the headset is.
We still don't. In fact, this is the picture they showed. Is a guy staring into a obviously prototype device with lots of glowing wires coming out of it.
As a nice article about, hey, VR is growing, and maybe this will finally be the time that it makes it, unlike this article that could have come straight out of the 1990s
right.
that talked about – I mean, it literally could have been a 1990s article about how VR was
someday.
But now, like, you know, the difference is people really are getting these headsets. If you have the Gear – like, you know, we were joking earlier, I've got three Gear VRs sitting around. You really can do it. And people really are kind of blown away by it. I was showing my business partner at the Gear VR where you have the dinosaur, and he was just like, oh.
It's really – it's cool, isn't it?
It really is.
So this is – go ahead.
I don't put on that often. Like,
Magic
cool.
Leap is AR, of course, and they've described it, but they haven't really described how it works as glasses that are lightweight and thin, and then they somehow magically – it just stuff appears in your field of view and your eye naturally focuses. They offer this video, but as Nilay says, well, yeah. But they explain nothing. What was it shot with? How is the camera focusing? Where is it focusing? Where does this stuff appear? And there's a call coming in from Google Hangouts. Is there an interface for Google Hangouts or is this just completely a mock-up? How does it know any of this information? You know, it's and Kevin Kelly never answers any of these questions. So while we're all kind of intrigued by Magic Leap, there's still absolutely no idea of how it works.
But you know, it's kind of funny that one of the impressive things about Magic Leap is their ability to prevent anybody from knowing anything.
Yeah, it reminds me of
They've raised $1 billion. They've gotten Google backing.
Yeah.
They, according to this article, the one thing that they hinted at that was somewhat intriguing was that the main core competency of Magic Leap is unique technology that makes the 3D aspect of it incredibly believable. And so, again, we don't know what that is, how it works or anything, but the fact that they have been able to raise that much money and at the same time they have the discipline to prevent us from knowing anything about it is in a way a suggestion that this company is somewhat formidable. I mean, it's very difficult to keep those kind of secrets.
Or they're Theranos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you know, given the history of the world, the latter is more likely than the former, to be honest with you. I'm not casting aspersions, but at some point you're going to have to show this technology to somebody, and it's going to have to be real. Everything we've seen, I think, is fake.
Well, I mean, the same goes to a certain extent for Microsoft HoloLens.
But no, because if people have tried it on and it works and you see what you see, it's disappointing, but it's real.
Exactly.
I mean, at least to Microsoft's credit, they're letting people buy them and try them on and use them. And so that exists, much as Oculus Rift exists. I'm not convinced that Magic Leap exists. Maybe
you just read an article that was inside Magic Leap. So what questions could you have?
Well, my son told me about a bottle that some Austrian inventors have created that pulls water out of the air and fills itself up. It's a magically refilling water bottle in an hour, even in the desert. It will fill itself up with water. And I said, well, you know, you read this stuff, you see these Kickstarter. It's like a crowdfunded campaign. You say, you got to really think, is that possible? Do they have one? Does it work? I'm still a little skeptical. I mean, I would love Magic Leap to be real. I will be the first to buy one.
Yeah.
Burr Feinstein, we all talked about it.
One. Plus, sea monkeys dance to music.
Yeah, and they do. They're real. They're alive. You know, maybe that's it. I bought too many things from the back of comic books to believe any of this stuff anymore. I bought X-ray glasses. I bought
a submarine.
Submarine.
Didn't really work.
I never got the plans for my hovercraft.
Okay. Do you want to talk about the UC Davis article in New York Times? You're quoted, Danny Sullivan. UC Davis, as everyone knows and remembers well, that was the New York Times complaining about my ad blocker. As many of you remember well, UC Davis, very famously in 2011, campus cops pepper sprayed students, nonviolent sit down protesters. And actually, if you watch the video, it's just horrific. Unfortunately, when you do a search, unfortunately for UC Davis, for the chancellor's name or UC Davis, you get this video. UC Davis didn't like that. They spent $175,000. Look at this guy. They're just spraying him. Like, trying to bury this video. They hired a company, Nevins and Associates. This is like reputation management, right, Danny?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing unusual about this other than it was by a public university
with
spending
public
a lot
funds.
Of public money
yeah.
and not actually doing it well. So, you know, so for like we didn't even run an article on it because this was like so commonplace, but, you know, it definitely got attention out there. It's reputation management. It's SEO, but very specialized SEO. The problem in this case is, first of all, they didn't like if you read the contract. I think I was described as saying I found it laughable. The contract didn't describe what it was they were trying to fix, like improve things, improve what. It didn't say that when you search for UC Davis, you were actually getting this stuff, or when you're searching for the chancellor's name. And in fact, the day the article ran about their attempts all those years later, those results were very clean. You know, years had passed, literally years had passed at this point, and it wasn't coming up that way. But the contract talked about trying to somehow get rid of all the results, which you were never going to be able to do. It is totally a case that a lot of reputation management companies will try to bring in new content that kind of pushes down the older content. But some of the older content, and maybe it's negative content, may disappear on its own anyway. But overall, it was a lot of money that they spent without any specific measurables about what they were getting. There was nothing like, and here's how we're going to prove that this actually worked, and if it didn't work, you're going to get your money back, or even kind of like, we can try this stuff, but it's not necessarily going to help. So after that learning experience, they decided to spend even more money with a second firm after working with the first firm for a year, not getting the results, and spend more money with the second firm, which may or may not have done anything different either. And then, of course, the whole thing comes out. And so now they get even more negative publicity off of what they were trying to bury in the first place, the whole Streisand effect that, you know, as it's known or whatever. They'd have been better off really just trying to, I don't know. I mean, one of the things they actually could have done is just dealt with the problem, right? Owned it, said, this is what happened at our campus. We're working to make sure it doesn't happen again and, you know, go on with it from there.
Yeah,
but
yeah, that's the way to deal with all of this, is deal with, yeah, deal with the right to be forgotten and all of that. You can't delete history unless you win. If you win the war, then you can do whatever you want.
In the EU, you can.
In the EU, you can. But so these are, just to make this clear, because I think a lot of people know, hear about this, then there, I don't do ads for, but there are a lot of radio ads for companies that do reputation management. What they do, they mention a low price thing that does absolutely nothing. Then for a significant amount of money, like $10,000 a month, they will generate a ton of content, kind of just stupid, meaningless content with your name attached, so that when people do a search, that content supposedly will rise to the top of search results. But you're saying, Danny, that kind of that
it really depends on the situation. So you have some people who are private individuals who maybe have fairly unique names. And when you search for them, if let's say they had gotten arrested and it ran in a local paper, that might show up because there's just not a lot of stuff. So if they go through and they create a Facebook account and a Twitter account and a LinkedIn account and all this other stuff, you know, Google tends to favor returning, if you will, brand pages, your personal pages, and it may be enough to knock that stuff down. And then they could go through and create lots of other content. And yeah, for that private person, it might be effective. You know, for a bigger company, it might help. It might help move it further down. Like, I haven't looked at the results for BP recently, right? But, you know, I'm pretty sure that BP's search results are not dominated by the oil spill. I'm taking a look at them now. There's Global, BP. Oh, well, I've got news results, but you're never going to get rid of the news results. But the rest of the stuff that's showing up there, you know, they're, you know, is not dominated. And so you're always going to have, like, for a brand, if there's something back in the news, the news stuff is fresh. You can't get rid of that. But yeah, it can be effective if it's done right and you're realistic about it may not always work the way that you want. And I think you're going to be even more effective if you understand that you go into the approach with not something that's so blatant, like we were trying to bury this other stuff.
Right.
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 You know, that if Davis had embraced this as, you know, this terrible thing happened on our campus, we were embarrassed about it, and here's the story of how we're improving it, it would have been so much more positive. Because first of all, they would have been taking positive action.
Right.
Instead, it just looks like you did this horrible thing, and now you're just trying to hope to get rid of it. Like, nobody remembers it, so.
One thinks it probably had a lot more to do with the chancellor trying to protect his name than anything else. But.
And just not understanding how the internet works. I mean, there's not any possible way that you can get this news story off of a search for UC Davis, because this is literally the biggest news that this university has produced in the last decade.
Well, right.
But it was off the results. I mean, it was just naturally off the result. I mean, you're right. You're never going to get rid of UC Davis pepper spray if you searched for it. But when you were searching for just UC Davis, this was not dominating the results.
Well, we're not dominating, but they're on the front page. One of the ways that Google search results work is that Google actually somehow tries to figure out – I'm not telling you this, Danny.
Right.
You knew this better than I do, but it tries to understand whether something's positive or negative. And if there's lots of positive, it throws in some negative. It tries to de-filter bubble the search engine results to make sure that there's some semblance of balance.
Oh, no, it doesn't do anything like that at all.
Well, if you
unless you're reading something different than I know.
No, if you look at Eli Pariser's Filter Bubble book, it actually addresses this this mechanism. It was one of Google's defenses against the filter bubble thing. The other one is which that Google claims that they don't filter search results, they only rank them. But if for example, I mean, I think this goes for all of us. Like, let's say, you know, Danny Sullivan is a beloved figure in technology journalism. Vast majority of things that people say about Danny Sullivan are very, very positive. And if a tiny minority of people say something negative, those are going to get an unusually high ranking in Google searches because they're negative and because so much of else of it is positive.
Ooh, that's not good.
It goes for Leo Laporte and Mike Elgin as well. If it tries to almost artificially balance positive against negative so that results can't be padded like you
Is it really doing that?
I don't think it's doing that. And it's been a while since I've read Eli's book, but I don't think it's trying to do that. And there's all sorts of bad things because if it was trying to do sentiment analysis of the different search results and then it said, hey, but let's just throw in some bad stuff. Anybody could just make up bad stuff. You know, it's really my understanding of the balance that it's trying to do. It tends to be more like to show a variety of results,
variety of sources as opposed to variety of sentiments.
But it, you know, if you could just go back and look at this, like you can do the search for UC Davis now, and before the story broke, there it wasn't there. I mean, I remember looking the day the story came out, and I looked, and there was nothing there. It was like the Wikipedia page, the Facebook page, the athletic site. They were one of, you know, their best college ranking thing, their YouTube page. There was no – and that's very standard for brands. If you do a search for, say, Target right now, right, or do a search for McDonald's right now, Google over the past few years has actually really shifted things so that if you're a brand, it just kind of rewards your standard stuff. There's a lot of people who hate McDonald's, right? Here I'm searching for McDonald's, and there's no don't shop at McDonald's stuff that's coming
up. It kind of brings up the standard McDonald's stuff, the official McDonald's stuff.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And a few years ago, you would have gotten that. Or if I search for, like, Diet Coke.
I'm sure that's the brands have put pressure on Google to do that, right?
Well, or they haven't directly done it. I think it's been a combination of Google, like, not wanting to deal with the hassles that if they're shifting more towards favoring stuff that's officially from a brand and someone's just searching for a brand, it's less controversial. You have less people getting angry at you. But people who are looking for something bad that they've heard about it still find it, right? So, you know, if you that's why if you go UC Davis, or even if you search for the chancellor at UC Davis, is Linda Katehi. I may not be pronouncing it right, but if you search for her on Google, her stuff was not that bad. You can see that the only real negative thing that was happening, like, was coming up in March. It wasn't even getting to the pepper spray thing. Yeah. So they made it worse for themselves by getting into the new stuff that was going on.
We were looking at the results. It's just really messed it up because
right. Because they generated all this new stuff trying to hide the new stuff that wasn't necessarily there anyway.
Right.
So
backfired. Well, there you go. Don't mess around. Just accept what our Google overlords say about you.
Well,
mostly right.
No, I mean, I
it's just hard. This is really hard.
It's like saying that if you were having negative stuff written about you in a newspaper, that you should just take it. No, you would probably wage a PR campaign. But there's a difference between waging a good PR campaign that has underlying it real change and good PR.
That's the way to do it.
Versus just a bad PR campaign.
And in fact, the UC Davis did a lot. They did an investigation. They put the officer on leave. I don't know if they ultimately fired him, but they did stuff. That's what you want to promote, not try to bury the story entirely. That's a mistake.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was just I would have been fascinated on how they actually did the research to find these companies. It was so That's the most annoying thing, all this. It was a lot of money wasted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because no one really seemed to understand what they were doing.
More than wasted, yeah. Hey, good news for free speech and for Google. The Supreme Court on Monday declined to consider the challenge to Google's book scanning project. A district court had said, somewhat reluctantly, but said that that was a fair use to scan those books within the boundaries of fair use. And while the Publishers Association appealed it, they have now been rejected by the Supreme Court, which means, I think, finally, the Google book case is over. That's the end of that. Unless there's a higher court that I don't know of. I guess they can go to the EU.
Yep.
We're going to take a break and come back with our final picks or tips or whatever. It's so great to have you, Mike Elgin from Mexico, off his jaunts
so
through Cuba.
Great to be here.
Yeah, really
so
appreciate
good to be on
it.
Show again.
And I love it that even though Mike is traveling about as light as you can with just a couple of backpacks, he packed a PR40 microphone with him, which weighs, it's not an inconsiderable amount. I mean, it's heavier than your laptop, probably. Did you bring
a
laptop?
Is an arm, oh, yes, I did, definitely. Right. I brought a laptop. Only in the necessities, only the very bare necessities. So the PR40, but not, I put in storage all the stuff that goes around it, the pop filter, the stand, all of that stuff. So that's why I'm holding it. But you got to have the PR40.
I'm so glad you brought it. I really am. Thank you. And of course, the interface that makes it possible to use that with Skype. So that's
exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Danny Sullivan also here. We always love Danny's insights. There's probably nobody who better understands how Google works. He is, of course, the founder of SearchEngineLand.com. Marketing Engine Land?
SearchEngineLand.com, which is all the search engine and search marketing advice and reporting. And then MarketingLand is our general one about digital marketing.
Yeah, both excellent sites. And Danny is just a great guy to have. We're going to come back with final words in a moment, but first, a word from Harry's. And if you're traveling, you ought to bring your Harry's with you. The bestest blades come directly to your door. And the reason I always bring my Harry's is because I have this great travel cover that you put your Harry's in. Oops, detached the blade. And then you put your Harry's in there and you put that in your shaving kit or your dop kit. And now you've got it safely ensconced. Harry's bought the factory that makes these fine blades, and they sell them to you at about half the price of the drugstore blades. Every bit as good a shave, of course, and they will send them to you automatically on a schedule with subscription. They ask you how often you shave, and then they decide how often to send you new blades, new shave foam or shave cream. I like the cream, but a lot of people like the foaming gel. Either way, you're going to get a fantastic shave for a fraction of the price. We just love Harry's. When I discovered Harry's, that was it. It was over for me. And I now have the Harry's Winston, the beautiful metal handles, the copper Winston. The winter Winston I got last Christmas. I have, of course, these nice Harry Trumans. They're great. Harry's are the best. So why pay $32 for 8 blades when you can get them for half the price direct from the factory? There's the German factory where they make them, designed for precision. And you can deliver it right to your door. We even have a special deal. They're so confident you're going to love your new Harry's shave for a limited time. You could try it for free when you sign up for a shave plan. You'll just pay $3 shipping. You'll get a beautifully crafted razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, the travel cover, $3, yours today. But here's how you do it. Go to harrys.com/twig. harrys.com/twig. You know, they say a well-groomed man is a handsome man. They see your face and they know you're honest. You have nothing to hide. And you don't want to cut it up and scratch it up with a bad blade. Get a fresh blade when you need one. Harrys.com/twig. Just $3 for that free Harry's kit just for the shipping. Usually we end the show with a tip or an idea. Mike has a tip for you. I'm going to pass along Jeff's number, which is that Instagram is on track for $3.2 billion in revenue. Instagram, of course, owned by Facebook. But this is, and when they bought it for $1 billion, everybody thought, oh, man, that is overpriced. Nowadays, you know, $1 billion for an app, that's nothing. WhatsApp cost $22 billion. And you know what? They got a good deal. Facebook got a good deal. Instagram, $3.2 billion in revenue next year. And that's pretty impressive. And almost 1 billion users, maybe even more impressive.
So it's on track to earn 3 Instagrams worth of
of Instagrams. Yeah. That's a good return.
Yeah.
That's a good return. Mike, do you have a number of your own, I think? I don't think he can hear us. He's just... silently. Mike?
It looks like he's drinking a champagne bottle there.
Let's see if we can call Mike back.
Maybe. I can sort of almost hear you.
You know, it's amazing.
Coming and going. I think my connection is weakening here.
The bandwidth just made it through the end.
I'll just go ahead and proceed. I assume I'm doing the number of the week, which is 15.
All right. Well, that's all we needed. 15. The number of the week is 15. Thank you very much, everybody.
It's like 42. What's the question?
I kind of know. Google's going to give $15,000 to three screenwriters, one for a feature film and two for episodic pilots, at the Tribeca Film Festival. It's the Computer Science Education and Media Program. And these pilots, I gather, will have to be about computer science, especially to inspire young people, especially girls and minorities, to do something in computer science. So good on them. $15,000 for three different screenwriters from Google, and they're announcing that today at the Tribeca Film Festival. Danny, do you have a tip or a number or anything you'd like to share with us?
I do have a number. I was trying to think, what's the number? And I was going through search engine land, and I realized I have the number 10, which are 10 big changes in search that I wrote in an article for my 20 years in covering search, which was on Sunday. Yeah.
20 years last Sunday?
20 years yes. So I've been covering
Congratulations.
Search for 20 years now. Thank you very much. So I kind of did – it wasn't really a retrospective. I just tried to go back and look through, and I was looking for some number to go with 20. So I thought we'll do 10 because I can't come up with 20 big changes. So, you know, I wrote this article, and it goes through, you know, kind of the revolution that search has been that I think people don't really take into account, this revolution of Google itself. And, you know, as you know, remember, Leo, we used to use OpenText or InfoSeek or web crawler.
Oh, my God.
And kids today have no idea. They've just kids. Grown up in a small Google world. So that was one of the other revolutions. I talked about the idea of Google becoming a destination, which is a significant change from when it was just a search engine. And there's some issues that go along with that. And the idea that our phones are like search phones more than smartphones, and what a big change that's been in terms of how we have this always on searching and we can look for stuff wherever we want.
Huge, huge.
Did a big thing where I talked about the death of 10 blue links that some people all hearing about. And I've got this giant side-by-side where I'm showing you like Google from 2002 versus what you get today. And
look at the change. Wow.
It's like it's all text, and now it's like here's some apps, here's some images.
Here's a carousel.
Spin through. Yeah. I talk about some of the bots and where that may be going. This is all new stuff that's coming in there, as well as the idea of machine learning. And then you know, the idea, and this is the part that always fascinates me, is how search is interacting with society, where we Google each other. Then my opening to this section was like, you know, who would have thought that when we had these tools that emerged to let you find anything, that 20 years later we would get laws about how you should be forcing them to forget what they know, right? Well, I mean, that's one of the huge impacts that we've had that's come off of search with it from there. So talk about search society stuff, the big change with search marketers, and then just at the end, kind of a – I don't know if it's so much of a trend. It's just so much of saying, gosh, you know – this stuff, search, is this magical gadget, if you will. It is this kind of rocket science that happens. We just take it for granted, just like we do the internet. We you know, Tesla, you know, brings out their new phone. Tesla. It's all mixed up. I had Tesla.
It is all mixed up, though. That's the truth of it.
But, you know, the SpaceX launches their rocket and brings it back down to Earth, and we're all gripped by that virally. Apple launches a new phone, and we line up and you know, go out to buy that. I'm like, ooh, now it's got 3D touch.
Right.
We never really kind of do that about the latest search features because they continue to be this evolution, and yet they're these amazing gadgets. So, you know, that was sort of like, wow, you know, the big trend is you've taken this magical thing, and it's just every day. But there's a lot of work and a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes for the people who make all that happen to make it so routine. And yeah, so, you know, that was it.
Great article. 10 big changes with search engines over my 20 years of covering them from Danny Sullivan. And boy, there's nobody better to write that article. And I'm glad you do remind us of what an amazing world we live in. I mean, that Mike started out by talking about how deprived people in Cuba are. If for no other reason, because they don't have access to the internet. We take it for granted, but it really has changed our lives. I didn't realize you'd been doing this for 20 years.
Yeah, it was. I tweeted the thing this was on Sunday night, I think it was. You'd have to go back in my tweets to find it, but I showed a little screenshot of the first thing I wrote. But I, you know, I had been a newspaper journalist in, gosh, after college through about the beginning of 95, and then went to work with a friend of mine to do web development. And part of what we were doing, we were putting people online and questions were coming about how the search engines were working. And so I spent some time researching and trying to understand what exactly were they doing, because no one really knew. They assumed that everything got crawled instantly and everything didn't get crawled instantly. People knew a little bit about meta tags and assumed that they made a difference, and mostly they didn't. And so I published all this in April 1996, the results of what I had studied over a few months of making changes to web pages, as well as an accompanying guide that I called A Webmaster's Guide to Search Engines, which was designed to say, look, you know, you're publishing stuff on the web. This is the stuff you need to understand on how the search engines are interacting with your stuff, because they're kind of like another browser. And at the time, you'll remember, people would be like, oh, I got to make sure it works for, you know, Mosaic, and I got to make sure it works well. Firefox, which is new, and I got to make sure it works well for this, I guess, Internet Explorer is coming out. And, you know, I would kind of was arguing to people, you also need to make sure things work for search engines, because they see some things, they don't see other things. And that kind of launched me on a new career that I hadn't anticipated.
Isn't that exciting? And you know what? What a great beat, really. And you've made yourself the expert in it, which is, I think, really, really fortunate. Follow Danny on Twitter if you're not, at Danny Sullivan. Lots of great tweets all the time, but Sunday's tweet.
Although it's Wednesday fun day, so it's happy hour that we'll be going to soon. So today's tweets will probably become somewhat inebriated in a bit.
even better. We'll look forward to it. You know what you do, which is great, is you link to a lot of other things that pique your interest. And it makes it, I think, a really this is kind of what the best of Twitter can be, is somebody who curates a lot of great content in his feed. And so he's absolutely worth following.
Cool. Thank you.
Danny, at Danny Sullivan on Twitter. Of course, you want to follow Mike Elgin, and when I say follow, I mean follow. This guy is a traveling man. He is all over the place. And he's in Mexico right now at Google Plus, too, Mike Elgin. And, of course, on Facebook as well.
Get Mike back.
Yeah.
And Twitter.
And
becoming nomad. If you're interested in digital nomad, the digital nomad lifestyle, I got some interesting stuff in there. I have a detailed list of every piece of gear that I use, because I get a lot of questions about what kind of backpack to use, what kind of, you know. And so it's all there for anybody who's interested.
That is a really great page on the site, becomingnomad.com. Next time, pick somebody with even better internet.
Wow. Yeah.
He's getting better. He's getting there. At least he's got internet now.
I think I'm going to go to South Korea next.
There you go.
Internet is so fast that, yeah.
Yeah. It's great to see you, Mike, however blurry. It really is great to see you again. And I've been following your travels with great interest. Continue to post and we'll continue to read them. Thanks to Danny Sullivan, Mike Elgin. Thanks to Jeff Jarvis. Couldn't stay with us because his connection in Germany was so bad. That's all right. I'm sure he wanted to go to bed anyway. He'll be back next week, as we will as well. 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. I'm sorry, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 p.m. Eastern time, 20:30 UTC every Wednesday. We do This Week in Google, This Week in Everything. It's the place where all the stories go. They all end at the end. It's kind of like the end of the downhill slope from the week, my week, because it's my last show of the week. And I get everything in that I want to talk about. And I'm glad you watch. If you would like to watch live, you could do so. If not, though, on-demand audio and video always available after the fact at twit.tv/twig or from your finest podcast aggregators. We are going to go to TNT next. They're still in Las Vegas at NAB. I think it's our last broadcast from Las Vegas, if I'm correct, as they wind down the NAB show. I will be back Saturday with the tech guy and the new screensavers. Megan Maroney will be my co-host on Saturday. And don't forget the return of Kate Botello, first weekend in May. Kate is going to be flying out from Michigan to join us for our one-year anniversary of the new screensavers and our 18th anniversary of the original screensavers, May 11th, 1998. So I've been doing this almost as long as you've been doing search, Danny. It's great to see y'all. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. on This Week in Google.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.